Ralph Branca joins us on Sports Byline. His book is called A Moment in Time. He played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the Detroit Tigers, and the New York Yankees during the 40s and the 50s. And he won 80 games for the Dodgers as a pitcher with a career-high 21. And, of course, probably best remembered for that one infamous relief appearance in a 1951 playoff game against the crosstown rival New York Giants. Branca entered the game in the ninth inning, and he surrendered a walk-off home run known as the shot heard round the world by Bobby Thompson, giving the Giants the National League pennant. Before we talk about that, Ralph, take me back to New York in the 40s and the 50s and baseball in that mecca.
Well, baseball in that era, right after the war ended, you know, in 45. So from 46 to 58, when the Dodgers and Giants left New York, you know, the Yankees won 9 out of 12 years. The Dodgers won 6. And the Giants stole a pennant 2 years, 51 and 54.
What was it that made baseball and New York City so synonymous with each other? I always thought it was the communities in which the teams played.
No, I think, you know, brothers and sisters, fathers and sons or daughters could root for a different team, so they'd have a basic argument about who's better, Reese or Rizzuto or Alvin Dark, or who's better, Mickey, Willie, or the Duke. So you had these arguments going on in neighborhoods and families. And so, you know, I think that made it great. And, of course, New York was the media capital of the world, so that's another point. But, you know, the Yankees were so good. I mean, they'd been terrific in the late 30s, and then they continued on in the 40s. You know, they won in 41, and then after the war, they won 47, 49, 50, 51, 52. I don't know. They won a number of years in a row.
Ralph, tell me a little bit about the image of each team and their fans. I mean, the Dodgers in Brooklyn, of course, and the Yankees as well as the Giants. Tell me about the image that each had in that city.
Well, I think the Brooklyn fans, you know, Brooklyn was considered like second class to Manhattan, which people call New York. You know, way, way back when, you know, Brooklyn was the farmland for New York City or Manhattan, and basically considered second-class citizens. They lived in Brooklyn, worked in Manhattan. The Bronx, which is where the Yankees were, basically it wasn't contained to the Bronx. The Yankees had fans all over. Like in my hometown of Mount Vernon, I'd say two-thirds of the fans were Yankee fans and one-third were Giant fans. And there was only one kid who was a Dodger fan because Brooklyn was a long way away. You had to take two subways to get to Brooklyn. So we had one Dodger fan and the rest were Yankees and Giants. And, of course, the Yankees were most successful from 36 to 58. But before, you know, and then the Dodgers and Giants left, so they were left alone in New York City.
You know, when you take a look at the different fields that each team played in, let's talk a little bit about the Dodgers' home field. I talked with the late Duke Snyder about it. I said, Duke, give me a sight, sound, and smell tour of Ebbets Field. And it was, I got goosebumps listening to him. Let me get your perspective on it as a pitcher. Tell me about Ebbets Field.
Well, Ebbets Field was very unique. The stands were built straight up, and there was not a whole lot of foul territory. So the fans were basically on top of the field. From, I'm going to say, home plate to the backstop was less than 60 feet. It's probably more like 50 feet, if that. And then as you went down each sideline, you know, towards the foul lines, it narrowed from that, say, 50 feet to 40 down to the bullpen. The bullpen was, I'm going to say, might have only been 20 feet from the stands to the foul line, the same in left field. I mean, he barely had space for two warm-up mounds in each place, but it was unique. It was straight up. You're right on top of the action. If you sat in the last row, you still were, I'm going to say, 60 feet deep, if that, to the last row of seats. Which Yankee Stadium had great expanse of seats, field level, where you'd be next to the dugout, but you could go back, oh, maybe I'm going to say 120 feet to the last row in the field. And then they had a loge, and they have an upper deck. And the Giants, it was an oblong field. They had room from the infield back, they had room. But then those lower stands went out to the foul line, and then it just had maybe 15 rows in left field and right field, and an upper deck, which in basically the same amount of rows. And it was an elongated field. It was more conducive, really, to be a football field because it was narrow and just oblong towards center field.
The other thing, too, about Ebbets Field, and particularly the ballparks at that time, is that they had advertising on the fences. And I know at Ebbets Field they had a guy who used to sell suits. Did they not?
Yes. Actually, they had a lot of colorful signs. You know, in left field, the wall was maybe 10 feet high, and right field, I want to say, it was 30 feet of concrete and then maybe 15 feet of fence, you know, that you had to hit it over the fence. Really, you had to elevate the ball to hit a home run in right field.
Yeah, I heard that if you hit the sign that had the guy that was sponsoring the suits, you got a free suit. Was that true?
Yeah, his name was Abe Stark. And if you hit the sign, win suit, well, guess where the right fielder played? right in front of the sign. The sign was maybe 3 feet high on the scoreboard. This was the base of the scoreboard. And it hit sign, win suit. I think of all the times that maybe the right fielder fell down and somebody hit the suit, hit the sign and won a suit. But I remember Frill saying he caught so many balls he was going to ask this Abe Stark for a suit. So I don't know if he ever got it.
Tell me a little bit, Ralph, if you will, about the atmosphere at Ebbets Field on game day, because you had a fiery manager in Lou DeRocher. You also had, as again, some of the players have told me that played with you, Pee Wee Reese and others, and Duke Snyder said that there were fans that would bring you food. There was one woman that would bring the players a cake, and he said it was just really like a community picnic sometimes at the ballpark.
That's right. I mean, the fans were... I think the Dodgers were loved, and they were like part of the family. I mean, those people were, you know, they loved the Dodgers, and they were knowledgeable. And I remember guys telling me if the Dodgers lost the day game, they didn't eat dinner. They were so distraught. And another guy, his first date, he took his then girlfriend or first date to the ballpark. And she said, he didn't talk to me after the game. She said, I almost dumped him then, but they ended up getting married anyhow.
You signed your first professional baseball contract when you were 18 years old. How did you end up with the Dodgers?
You know, I was a Giant fan. And my sister, my older sister, had written to the Giants, the Yankees, and the Dodgers for me and my older brother, John. John's a year and a half older than, was a year and a half older than me. So we went to the Polo Grounds, and it rained. So they canceled that tryout. Let's say it was on a Monday, and the Giants were out of town. So the next day, they had everybody come back. There might have been 300 kids there, which was nonsense. You know, you're not going to see 300 kids. So my brother John threw, like, right at home plate. They had a warm-up area. And I was next, and he said, tryouts are over. And my brother John goes, whoa, whoa, you haven't seen my brother throw. He said, no. We have time for him. Well, you sure he's going to come? Oh, yeah. He said, we know his name. We'll get back with him. Well, of course, they never did. Then we went to Yankee Stadium maybe 2 weeks later, and I threw. Now, I'm only 16, but I'm a skinny kid, you know, like 6'2", maybe 6'2 and a half, weighed about 150, 55. And I threw, and I had a scout named Chief Bender, and he was part Indian. So I threw, and I threw pretty hard, you know, for 16-year-old kid, and he said, what else you got? I said, curveball. So I threw my three-quarter curve. He said, what else? I said, a drop. So I threw an overhand curve, which I call a drop. He said, that's an overhand curve. He says, okay, let me see you throw hard again, and I threw a couple fastballs. He said, how old are you, son? I said, 16. He said, oh, you're too young. We'll get in touch with you next year. Well, they never did, and on my card it says, in the Yankee office, they told me that said, too young, get in touch with him next year, which was, it would have been 1943. And then we went all the way out to Brooklyn, way out in Coney Island. It was the longest subway ride you could take, like, I think it was 32.6 miles. We took one train, the Lexington Avenue line to Grand Central, then shuttled over to Times Square and took the BMT all the way to Surf Avenue. And we worked out there, and the field was a very unique field. The right field fence had wheels on it. It was called Celtic Oval. Well, if a game started, they rolled the right field fence back across the street, back to where it was. You had to hit the ball at least 300 feet to get a home run. So I pitched in, and the Dodger scouts liked me. So they asked me to throw batting practice because I got a little swelled head. But, you know, 16 years old in August of that year, so I threw batting practice. And they followed me. They kept in touch with me. And the next spring, when the Dodgers, just before the season started, they used to play three exhibition games, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So they asked me to come back again and throw batting practice. And they stayed on top of me. And I never did hear from the Giants or the Yankees, so I ended up signing with the Dodgers.
Ralph Branca is with us. The name of the book is called A Moment in Time, An American Story of Baseball, Heartbreak, and Grace. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline.